From KUAC FM in Fairbanks, this is Sunday at Noon. I'm your host, Susan McInnes. For a while now, I've been interested in building a loose series of programs on the subject of health and of healing. As we move through the Sundays of 1990, I'll hope to call on people who can help us take a look at health from different perspectives, medical, psychological, and spiritual, for example. Today, as we open this series, I've invited a local counselor and consultant to give us an alternative perspective on health and healing, one that takes into account the body's physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual states, and looks at ways the individual can be a healer in his or her own life. Is health the absence of disease? Is it a cultivated sense and state of well-being? Is it finding balance and relative well-being regardless of the presence or absence of illness, of stresses, or of problems? To help us take a look at these questions, I've invited counselor and personal consultant Sally Fenno. Welcome, Sally. From your perspective, what is a state of health, and what factors are most important to you in determining health in one's life?
Well, it seems to me that health is primarily a matter of balance. Balance among one's various states, as you mentioned, the spiritual, the mental, emotional, and physical. And that's not the same for everyone. In other words, the same proportions don't apply to each person, which is why it's difficult to say across the board what any particular person should do in order to be healthy.
And let's get this major word defined as well. You said balance and proportion. Can you give us a picture of what that is for you?
Well, if one is in conflict between, for example, one's thoughts and one's feelings and one's actions, one's spiritual framework and one's emotions, so on, those would all be imbalances. They would lead to a lack of harmony.
Mm-hmm. And do you think most of us walk around in balance or out of balance?
Well, I think probably we're always attempting to balance. And balance, when I think of balance, one of the main images that comes to my mind is that of a small child learning how to walk. In other words, in order to walk, you must be willing to be, in a sense, always off balance. Balance requires movement. A lot of people, we tend to think that balance is something that's stagnant. In other words, you can attain balance and then you're
hold
there forever and you never move again because you've got it. But the problem is that we don't exist in a vacuum. So once you attain what you consider to be balance, something in your environment changes. And if you don't move, you will be out of balance.
So we have a dance here, don't we?
Yes, a constant interaction and movement. And dance is a word that I like because I think of all the components of our life as music. And if we move in tune to whatever music is playing in whatever situation we happen to be in, if we listen to that and move accordingly, then we will tend to be in harmony with ourselves and with the situation.
So in this way, the word health doesn't have a great deal to do with presence or absence of illness. I could be quite ill, and yet, by your definition, I could be healthy, yes?
I think that that could be the case. I don't have a strong opinion about that because I think there's so much that's unknown. I know people who say that, who feel that every time they get a cold, it means they've thought something incorrectly or done something wrong, and I don't necessarily subscribe to that point of view. I do think that sometimes illness, physical illness, can be the like the most obvious manifestation of a pattern of imbalance. But whether we can totally correct that by changing our thoughts or our feelings, I don't know, because we have our genes and our chromosomes, our inheritance, and all of that to take into account as well. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would say, for example, if you're born with some debilitating factor, there certainly isn't anything to say that you can't compensate for that and be a healthy person in your environment.
I want to take a look at, because it seems earlier you introduced thoughts about being in imbalance, for example, between your emotions and your thinking, or your emotions and your spirit. Is where we put our attention, where we put our thoughts, a major factor in determining balance or health?
Well, I think that where we put our attention to a large degree determines what we would call our reality, our personal reality. I don't mean that the totality of reality is different for every single person, but I do think that we always have choices. For example, in this room, there are many, many different things that you could put your attention on, different things you could choose to look at, different things you could choose to listen to. And at any moment, something that I say or something that happens in the room could cause you to switch your attention to your thoughts, for example, which may be thoughts that come to you relative to what has been said, memories that that resonate to what has just happened, and then your attention would no longer be fully on what's going on. So in a way, you're not really here anymore. Mm-hmm. You are, but you're not. And I think everyone can relate to that to some degree and can practice that themselves and see that indeed that's so.
And so the influences of who comes in the room, it might be different if my boss came in the room, if my mother came in the room, if my closest friend came in the room, could all affect my reality.
Certainly.
And can we get literally shoved out of shape by someone who comes in the room or about our, over our opinion about something that's happening in the room?
I think that it's, my experience has been that it's very difficult for me and for everybody else I've ever known to stay grounded in the present. In other words, for me to fully listen to you, for example, mm-hmm. to completely put my attention on you, that's difficult because my attention might shift to thoughts that I have about what you're saying, and then I'm not completely there anymore. So meditation practices and any practices that have to do with focusing of attention are based on the attempt to learn to know the difference between, say, for example, what is happening and one's thoughts about what is happening, or direct experience, for example, to look at this table. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, your thoughts would probably go to whether you like the table or not, whether it's practical, what color it is, what materials it's made out of. And that takes you, you might as well then be a million miles away.
For one thing, because I'm not looking at the table, I'm looking at my thoughts about the table.
Right, you're looking at the table.
It's not sturdy enough.
Well, right, physically, you know, you might be looking at the table, mm-hmm. but your attention is not on the table. Your attention has shifted to thoughts about it.
Give our listeners a context here, and then I want to continue with this discussion. Why should we attune ourselves, for example, to this table rather than our thoughts about the table? Why should we attune ourselves to the conversation rather than our thoughts about the conversation? Why does it matter?
Well, I don't know that it matters for everybody. I don't know that I would say people should or should not do that. However, when we're having difficulties, when we're unhappy, when things are not going the way we want them to, it's often due to thoughts that we're having about a situation rather than the situation itself. We can't always change our situation in life. And I'm not suggesting that we change our thoughts, but more that much of the time, the way we experience our lives, the way we experience other people, the way we experience events, our jobs, and so on, are more composed of what we're thinking about them mm-hmm. than what they actually are. And then the other step from there is that what we think often gives rise to feelings. In other words, if I'm sitting here and you're talking to me and I have just a transient thought, she doesn't think I know what I'm talking about, that would immediately then give rise to emotions.
Fear, insecurity.
Or whatever. Yeah,
anxiety.
Whatever. Anger, resistance, anything. Mm-hmm. But then the whole situation has taken on a tone that is not based in reality, or at least I haven't checked out that it's based in reality. So what we think has a great deal to do with what we feel.
And what if you're in your emotions and I'm in my emotions? You're sitting there thinking she doesn't think I know what I'm talking about, and I'm sitting here thinking, oh my God, I can't think of the next thing to say, and I'm all confused.
Right.
And
then we're just like just about everybody else almost all the time.
We walk around and talk like that. We stay inside our thoughts. How hard it is then to have not just a decent conversation, but a decent relationship or an understanding of what reality is.
Right. I think it's amazing, really, that people ever can communicate with each other, that we ever truly get a glimpse at all of who another person really is, looking through all our own, it's sort of like curtains hanging in front of us.
Lenses, filters, screens.
Mm-hmm.
I should tell people who have just tuned in that this is Sunday at Noon. You're listening to KUAC-FM. I'm Susan McInnes, and we're talking with Sally Fenno. Today, in the next hour or so, we'll be talking about various layers of reality, I assume, and health and balance from an alternative point of view. It's kind of a psychic point of view, is it not?
Well, that would be, I suppose, one way to look at it. My framework is, I think, more based on Eastern philosophy, which actually was my framework before I knew it was Eastern philosophy, but when I discovered Eastern teachings, particularly some Tibetan Buddhist teachers that I've been fortunate enough to have, it gave me a context for things that I had already observed to some extent and wondered about.
If we are up in the upper attic of our anxieties most of the time, how do you, when you talk to people about this state, help them to move out of that attic? Or is it a process of moving out of the attic?
It's definitely a process, and for most people it would be a lifetime process, in the sense that it's not, I don't see it as a linear procession from having one's attention totally on one's thoughts and memories and fantasies to having one's attention 100% of the time on what's going on in the present moment. I think that it seems to me that no matter how much people practice, that our attention does shift a great deal. And if anyone were to ask me how to begin that process, I would suggest some very practical exercises having to do with paying attention to what's going on around one.
For example?
Well, for example, if at this moment your attention shifts to thoughts about what's happening and you want to bring your attention back, I would suggest that, first of all, you orient yourself by using your physical senses. In other words, maybe wiggling your toes or becoming aware of your hands, noticing the breath coming through your system. What are you hearing? What are you seeing? Because when you want to orient yourself in the present, you first have to ask yourself, where is the present?
And the present is where my body is.
Right.
And where your body is, the distance between us, and secondly, then, the conversation that's going on between us.
It seems to me our body is the marker in time and space. In other words, for any individual person, the present is where your body is.
And you've said to me before that most of us walk around outside of our bodies most of the time. Is that what you mean by being in our thoughts or in our emotions?
Yeah, out of present time, not at one with ourselves, which to me is what balance is. It's being at one, attuned, which are really like similar words. In other words, when the various parts of us are lined up more or less in the same time and space, then we're fairly well at one with ourselves.
And those various parts, again, spirit, emotion, intellect, and body, all seated together finally in the same room instead of some of us at Aunt
For a minute or two anyway.
Can we, this is probably the question of the hour, can we in 1990, with an accelerated pace in our society, an accelerated pace in our own lives. I mean, most of us try to keep together family and relationships with lovers, mates, children, other people around us, plus work, whether we're just barely on the edge of any sort of economic stability or not, or whether we're striving for the second BMW, plus we try and keep some relationship with our society going, all at the same time, in a life that is much different than those of us who are now adults were raised to anticipate. I suppose my question is, can we keep it together in 1990? And if we can, how hard is it? And is it harder than the cleavers were anticipating in the mid-60s when Leave It to Beaver first came on television? Pardon me for that.
Well, I didn't grow up with television because I grew up in the bush, but I know what you're talking about. I think that the more complex life becomes, the more essential it is for one's well-being to be able to focus, to be able to pay attention, to be able to stay present. Someone told me one time something about if you always have enough time if you're in the present.
And most of us would say we don't have enough time.
Well, that's because our attention isn't in the present. We're thinking what we did, what we should do, what we have to do, how we can't do it, and so on. So we're strung out, we're spaced out. Our attention is on so many things in addition to what we're actually doing at the moment that it's like we're doing 10 things at once. Mm-hmm. So you get very tired and get very little satisfaction out of what you actually are accomplishing because your attention isn't there. You're not focused on it, you see. So I think the busier we are, the more important it is to stay focused. You know, that doesn't mean you can't go home and get out your, you know, your daily diary and write down all the things you need to do. It doesn't mean not looking ahead and planning in some way. But when we are doing what we're doing, I think it's extremely important to sort of bring ourselves all together and be all in the same place, or what I think of as take all of yourself with you wherever you go. Try to not leave parts of yourself behind or stretch parts of yourself out into the future or up into the sort of never-never land, which is fantasy and imagination. All of those have their place. You know, if you want to remember the past, then sit down and remember the past. If you want to think about the future, then sit down and think about the future. If you want to fantasize, then sit down and fantasize. What is unsettling is doing all of those at the same time as you're physically doing something else.
Making a casserole and doing
right.
The rest of that. A time management consultant would probably say that it's far more efficient to bring all of your parts into place mm-hmm. in the present, too, when the casserole gets done mm-hmm. rather than burned.
And you might have actually enjoyed doing it. Mm-hmm. You might have had some pleasure from, you know, chopping up the celery or whatever.
You've talked about walking meditations as another tool when you and I have talked in the past. Can you describe that to people?
Movement combined with paying attention can be very grounding, as most people who do sports or exercise know. You know, you've got like your inner game of golf, your inner game of, I don't know, tiddlywinks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think those things are based on what we're talking about here. In other words, when your body is moving, it is easier to pay attention. Your body feels more real. You don't feel quite as removed from yourself. I think that most of us in this culture, which is the only one I can speak for, have so many years of being disconnected from ourselves in the way that we're talking about by having our attention elsewhere other than where our body is, that sometimes it takes a real effort, a particular type of effort to reconnect the various parts of ourselves. In other words, more than just thinking about our feet or, you know, paying attention to sensations and sounds and so on, and that movement sometimes, for some people, can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Many Western people, I think, don't find themselves as suited for sitting meditations. Not that there's anything incorrect. They have centuries and centuries and centuries use behind them. But for many people in the Western culture who want to learn to pay attention, who want to bring themselves together in the way that we're talking about, sitting down as an adult and attempting to force the body to sit still in an unfamiliar posture sometimes is counterproductive. And I think that there are other ways in addition to that for some people that can be as useful.
And for practical purposes, describe a walking meditation.
Well, I'm not an expert on walking meditation. Walking meditation is an actual term. If I were to do a walking meditation, or if I were to suggest to someone that they do one, you could do it in your living room, or you could do it outdoors. And it would involve simply moving, walking slowly, and or however you felt comfortable doing it, and keeping your attention on what you were doing.
So it's on the fact that my feet are moving, on the fact that my lungs are breathing. Is it also on the trees that I'm passing? Or is it more internal? That's what I'm wondering about. Am I pulling myself inside of myself as I am moving? Or am I putting myself outside to the world around me as I'm moving?
Well, you know, a lot of meditation is based on being aware, actually, of your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would suggest. In fact, a Tibetan teacher of mine once told me, if you can keep your mind from wandering while you take 10 in and out breaths, you will have reached enlightenment.
Just 10, but it's the getting there.
And
right?
At that point, I asked him if he had reached enlightenment. He said, oh, no.
Sally, what's random cognition? When you said keep your mind from wandering, I remembered a phrase that you gave me a couple of nights ago when we were talking.
Well, again, I would have to go to some degree to what one of my teachers gave me as an image. Actually, I had one teacher who referred to it as a popcorn popper, and someone else who simply gave me an image that led me to think of a glass of soda water, where you can watch, and occasionally a bubble will arise and just come to the surface. And thoughts arise.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they come from or why, but what we're talking about here is you can spend a great deal of time following your random thoughts, or you can let them come to the surface and just sort of dissipate. There's a great deal of difference between thoughts that arise and thinking, which to me is application of the thought process, direct application.
Purposeful.
Yes, purposeful. Mm-hmm.
Most of us, it would seem to me, much like we were talking about at the beginning of our hour, follow our thoughts around, kind of like a dog, the master.
Right. Or a Zen person would say the monkey. It's the monkey mind. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. It's follows everything. It's curious about every little thing. It's always chattering on and running up the tree to look at something new.
I once heard it described as a drunken monkey who's just been stung by a bee. So even more so.
That's a nice image, yeah.
Pardon me. This is not healthy to just follow your thoughts around, is it?
I think for most of us, no. I don't think that it leads us to feeling very calm or balanced or at one with ourselves and our surroundings. I think that we divert ourselves a great deal by spending time following off random connected thoughts. I mean, after all, the mind is like a computer. It's not just a computer, but it's like a computer, and it's full of all kinds of information and that connects up with each other. So if you start following one thought, it leads to another, it leads to another, it leads to another, and so on. And there's no end to that, generally.
In the computer analogy, it's without much power of discrimination.
No, because our associations are very individualistic and personal. In other words, the association you have with a particular dog walking into the room or something may be totally different than each other individuals in the room. And those associations, some of them may be similar because we were raised in the same culture, but many of them are extremely personal.
So once again, as we follow our dog around in random cognition, we come up with thoughts and feelings and those thoughts that connect with feelings. And this is... Mm-hmm.
Right, and then you wake up, you're halfway down Airport Road and think, oh my God, where have I been the last 10 minutes?
Right, and I forgot to buy the milk and I haven't gotten the this and I'm on the way to work without
right.
any of my notes.
And did I go through any red lights or or what?
Yeah.
And that's often what wakes us up, is someone pulling out in traffic in front of us, either literally or metaphorically.
So in some ways in 1990, it's very important to stay balanced mm-hmm. because things are going to change on us faster than they would in the 50s or 60s or 70s.
Things are moving very rapidly. I've heard it said that time is speeding up, but I don't know about that. I know it feels that way sometimes.
I want to explore the question of power and powerlessness. It seems to me if we are following around our drunken bee-stung monkey of a mind, or even our dog out for a walk of a mind, that we are not, as individuals, taking power in our own lives, over our lives. That is to say, we're not directing. Is that an accurate read?
I understand what you're saying. When we're not paying attention, we are not available in the present to make choices. And the result of that is that we often feel powerless. And I'm not talking just about physical choices mm-hmm. out here, because many things in our life we can't really change or have an effect over.
Okay.
You know, the light
yeah.
turns green, it's raining on your picnic, it's your dog ate your shoe. But how we respond to our environment, that is to say our setting, which changes from moment to moment, how we respond is something that generally we do automatically. I think of it as like being on autopilot. In other words, I grew up in the bush and my dad had an airline, and we'd go flying and I'd wonder how we could be flying to Anchorage and he was sitting up there reading Westerns and we weren't running into the mountains. And that's how most of us go through our lives, where the autopilot is all set. The responses are programmed, they're pre-selected basically, either on the basis of what we've been taught or on the basis of convention or perhaps at some time individual choices we may have made in response to particular circumstances.
I like this, I don't like this, I'm this kind of person.
Yeah.
I'm not this kind mm-hmm. of person, I don't do those kinds of things.
Right.
All mm-hmm. examples of autopilot.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with having some things programmed in on automatic, right? You don't want to have to learn how to tie your shoe every time you tie your shoe. You don't want to have to give it that degree, the degree of attention you did when you were four, for example. However, choices of response are very powerful. And this is the area where generally we end up feeling powerless. You made me feel that way. If you hadn't said that, I wouldn't be feeling like this. Therefore, you did it to me. Therefore, I'm powerless. Not only that, I might punch you or something. Yeah, that's that level of feeling that my emotional responses, the way I'm feeling about things, have nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. I would feel then at the mercy of my environment constantly. Now, part of that is the emotional response is often a response to a thought that goes by so quickly that we don't see it. See, again, maybe we sat down here and you poured yourself a glass of water and you didn't pour me one, right? Mm-hmm. I might find myself feeling sort of left out or, just feeling a little uneasy. Well, if I were able to slow down enough and kind of backtrack that, or if I were paying attention, I might have caught the thought, oh, she doesn't really care about me. She didn't give me any water. And if that's indeed is what I thought, then of course I would feel a little left out. You see, in other words, my emotional response is not directly caused by what you did, but by what I thought, by the judgment I made of what you did. Now, you may have been totally abstracted, and it may have had absolutely nothing at all to do with your attitude toward me, you mm-hmm. see. But if I'm telling myself, this means this about her, therefore, this is how I'm feeling, that creates a very powerful component of our interaction with each other. Now, if I could slow that down and notice that I have these thoughts, that maybe I tend to be a bit hypersensitive and take things personally, and I'm practicing paying attention, I may at some point be alert enough at that point of response to realize that I might have a choice of response. Mm-hmm. In other words, instead of thinking, oh, Susan doesn't really care whether I have any water or not, I might think, oh, she didn't pour me any water, I'll ask for some. Or, oh, I can see she's really busy, I'll pour my own water, or whatever. Now that's going to have an impact on my emotional state. So when people say they don't have any control over their emotional states, they don't have anything to say about that, you have to backtrack a bit and slow things down enough through paying attention, through practicing attentiveness, to be able to catch the thought that then led to the emotional response. Unless it's something like somebody jumps out of the bushes and is going to stab you, my God, of course, you're going to run screaming, get out of the way. You're not going to stop and think, well, maybe he doesn't really. There are survival situations which are different.
But in our daily lives, mm-hmm. frequently we do just that. We think, she doesn't like me, or it means something about me, I'm not mm-hmm. very good, which is why we probably have mm-hmm. a culture preoccupied with issues of self-esteem.
Well, which is why we have an economic system based on an advertising system that's constantly telling how we can be okay, because it works so well.
And the inverse of that is that we're not okay. We don't have enough things.
Right. It's not okay. It's not true, but we'd like to believe that we could feel better by having certain things or looking a certain way.
Or instantly having water when we need it. Mm-hmm. So once again, are we not putting our needs outside of ourself? If we have the right clothes, or if someone pours water exactly when we need it, everything would be fine?
Well, we always have our preferences. You know, we will always have preferences. I might prefer that that my car not run out of gas while I'm, you know, driving down the middle of the road. But that's different than getting totally bent out of shape when something happens. Mm-hmm. It's not that you can't really totally neutralize yourself, I don't think. And I don't think that's the aim. I don't think that has anything to do with health either. But when we have such strong reactions to things happening around us, and we do, we're human beings. It's the human component of being a human being that that contains that emotional mm-hmm. part. That, to me, that's the connecting link. It's the interface between the spirit and then the body. The emotions seem to me that they're right in there in the middle. And I don't think most people would want to get rid of them. It's what allows us to really enjoy a sunset, or really care about each other, and so on. So it's not something to get rid of by any means, but to realize that we're often prey to our pre-programmed assumptions and beliefs, and therefore find ourselves maybe with emotional responses that color our reality in a way that leads us to not being satisfied. And when we're not satisfied for long periods of time, when we're angry or sad or fearful over long periods of time, often then we tend to get what we call sick. Mm-hmm. I think that it can happen, that there can be an imbalance. I mean, all kinds of research has been done on, say, the endocrine system, how that connects up with our emotional response patterns, and how that then connects in with our mental states. Those are all interconnected. They interpenetrate each other. You can't take any part away from the other and still have a human being. They can be studied separately, but when it comes right down to it, you can't show me love. Mm-hmm. You can't show me a thought. These are not visible to us, except in the way that they interpenetrate the rest of our system.
And in that, they have great life.
Well, yes. without, you know, this. You asked me one time, what did I think spirit was? And to me, that's what animates us. It's almost, you can't really see what spirit is. You can see when it's gone. I mean, then we say, oh, you know, that mosquito's dead. You can tell that. How can you tell? Well, it can't function. It's not moving. It has no life in it anymore.
Ever so much more with a friend or a pet. A mosquito. Few of us stop and look and wonder if the spirit that animated that mosquito is gone or present. But with an animal that you loved and cared for, which is gone, and you look at the body, you can definitely tell that the spirit that was your pet is gone. Or if those of us who have had a friend die or a loved one die, looking at that person, you know that the personness is no longer.
Something's
there.
Not there anymore.
Uh-huh. Now, you have said, I should, for those who've tuned in quite late in this hour, I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Sunday at Noon. You're tuned to KUAC FM. And my guest today is Sally Fenno. We're talking about a broad range of subjects under the umbrella of health and healing. You have said earlier in our discussion that I'm reminded of the priest who said it would take a lifetime to reach the enlightenment through 10 undistracted breaths.
Actually, he would probably say it would take a thousand lifetimes.
No ending to it. And that it is also a lifetime process to bring our thoughts to the present, to bring ourselves to the present. Is this also, when you're talking about finding some sort of emotional balance in this dance of life, is it also a process of tuning ourselves, retuning ourselves, reattuning ourselves to our emotional lives? And are there ways that we can go about that?
It's a practice. Huh. It's not practice like you practice something and then you get it.
It's not the violin.
No. It's a practice. In other words, it is something that you do, and then you do, and then you do. You don't do it until it's perfect, and then you can quit paying attention, and you'll still be paying attention without paying attention. You can't go back to sleep and still be awake. If you want to wake up, then you have to stay up. You know, you might occasionally lie back down, but when you wake up, you get up again.
Right.
In other words, you can't stay asleep. You can't go unconscious and still be conscious. You can't go unaware and still be aware. It's not that kind of thing. It is a practice.
So every time I find myself slipping into hypersensitivity of some sort, that is not going to be self-protective in the idea of the guy leaping out with the knife.
Right, I would call that a
good idea.
Not hypersensitive.
Right. But some sort of self-destructive hypersensitivity. Every time I do that, I need to stop and say, Suze, what's going on here?
Right, what am I telling myself?
What am I telling myself? What do we tell ourselves commonly?
She doesn't care about me. Hmm. She doesn't really care what I want. She thinks she's better than I am. She's selfish.
She's talking down to me again. Doesn't like my reports.
I really should have worn, you know, a different pair of shoes. On and on. We go on and on and on.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's childhood stuff. There might be tapes there of when people did tell us things like that about ourselves, that we've sort of taken over that process. You know, Mrs. Green, our fourth grade teacher, doesn't have to be standing there saying, oh my God, can't you ever dot your I's right? Because we've taken that function over ourselves. See? So we don't have to have somebody there telling us what it really means. We're telling ourselves what it really means. But what it really means is what it is.
Are these all illusions? You've talked about the illusion in the past when you and I have talked. Are all these overlays and filters representative of the illusion in which we walk?
Well, I think different people would have... I think the word illusion translated into English coming from the Eastern... context would have a very, very specific meaning, and probably there would be a whole book written about it. to me, if I take my interpretation of a situation, which is very different than the actual situation, as being the situation itself, then I'm experiencing the situation in an illusory way. In other words, if you don't pour me a glass of water and I say that that means you don't care about me and so on, then I have experienced the situation in an illusory way. I've added something to it that makes it very different than what it is.
So once again, it's a good table, it's a bad table, it's a good tree, it's a bad tree. It's a good person, a bad person.
But we always have our preferences, see? We always have our preferences. I mean, for me to like this table or not like it, that's my preference. But for me to impose that on the table itself, in other words, to say that makes it a bad table, that is different than saying, I don't care for that table.
Or if it makes it for you a bad day because you've got to sit down at
this stupid
table.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
See, there's a difference. If I interpose my assumptions and beliefs and don't know that I'm doing it, and I see them as actually part of the table or the person, then I'm in illusion. I mean, I'm not seeing things clearly. I'm not experiencing things directly. I've added something to it that makes it very different than it is. Now, for example, if I'm aware of my prejudices, that may be a different matter. I'd say, gee, this table reminds me of some other table that I had once that I didn't really like, but this actually isn't a bad table at all.
Uh-huh. Once again, bringing it up to a conscious level, you bring it out of the realm of fantasy or history or emotion or...
Right, it seems like looking through, if you put your hand out in front of you and hold your fingers apart, I can look at you through that hand.
Little barred fingers.
Right. Or I can shift my focus and look at the hand itself. If I want to see... It's just an image, a way of talking about this. If I want to become aware of what I'm experiencing life through, then I have to learn to shift my focus. And to me, that's that constant practice.
And the question there, are we looking at the hand or are we looking at the person?
Right.
And if we want to look at the person, we have to take the hand away.
Well, you can't do that until you see that there's a hand there.
Hello. Okay.
Which involves shifting one's focus. That's where I say that paying attention, becoming aware of what we tell ourselves about how things are, or how we are.
Listen to what's going on in your head. Slow your processes down so you can pay attention to what's happening. Catch the thought, she didn't give me a glass of water, which led, bam, to she hates me.
Right. And nothing changes the fact that she didn't give me a glass of water.
Mm-hmm.
However, I may, over time, notice, if I pay enough attention, that what I interpreted that action as meaning may not be correct at all. And I may be able to shift my thought or have no thought at all about it, but simply an experience of it. It's very difficult. Thoughts are very quick. It's very hard to see the place of those assumptions and beliefs in our moment-by-moment life.
And it has to be hard also because thoughts aren't physical. They go by, like you say, so quickly. We don't have a record of them necessarily, except in our emotions, so that we may tend to discount them and say, oh, well, it was just what I was thinking at the time. It means nothing. It was just, I just said that. It means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than stopping and saying, I did think that, I did say that, what value does that have in terms of how I now feel? Or a moment ago I was driving 40 miles an hour in the 40 mile an hour zone and all of a sudden a guy came in front of me and I decided I had to pass him at 80. What happened?
Right. That idiot, he can't do that to me.
Right. So stop and check where our behaviors become a little bizarre, a little nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I was fine 2 seconds ago, now I'm not. What happened?
Right. If I let him pass me, I mean, that means that he's going to get away with thinking that he can do that, and he probably thinks I'm a real wimp because he could just pass me like that, and I'm not doing anything about it, and I'm not going to let him get away with that.
Mm-hmm. And is it just a problem? Again, I'm beginning to look again at our master subject for this hour here, the subject of health and healing. Is it just a process of dragging ourselves back from 80 miles an hour and say, Suze, come on, how'd we get this fast? Well, first of all, slow down. Now, how'd we get this fast? Is it just dragging myself back to the guy who cut me off and my thoughts about him?
Yeah, it's noticing on what basis you made that choice. Mm-hmm. You may not have been aware at the time of making the choice at all. But I think this kind of process is very interesting because you never learn everything there is to know. It generally gives one an opportunity to be more balanced. And to, as I said, balance doesn't mean not having any emotions, mm-hmm. not by any means. It means realizing the place of emotions, realizing the place of thoughts, and most of all, realizing how little of our time do we actually have our attention in the present on what's going on. Again, to refer to one of my teachers, told me once that most people go through their life as if they're in a dream. And he said, then you would get to the end of your life and look back and it would be just like a dream. Mm-hmm. You have not made the choices that you could have made. You hadn't been involved with life in as immediate way as you could have been. You have not taken the opportunities for insight and increased awareness and opportunities for being helpful that you could have taken, and that what you learn and the degree to which you're able to be helpful are very important in that particular structure, which is a structure that I loosely live my life within also. Mm.
Philip Kaplow, in his mm-hmm. book, The Wheel of Life and Death, quotes, and I can't, right now the person he's quoting escapes me, but I will have to paraphrase, but he says that those of us who have lived least full lives, most dreamlike lives, scream loudest when death comes to us, and those who have lived the fullest in the present, in the moment, with all their emotions and intellect mm-hmm. and spirit participating, scream the least and are most willing to say, yes, all right, I've had my beginning and my middle and now my end. Your thoughts on that?
I would think that that would be so. If you allow yourself to dance with life and engage with it fully, the parts that you like, the parts that you don't like, the parts that are just blah and you don't have, which is most of life, you know, dishes and shopping and stuff like that, you experience an intensity of involvement and you know you've lived. You know you're living every moment because you can experience it. You're there. You're involved. You're walking across the road and the snow is coming down on you and you can feel it and you can see the light and your thoughts aren't somewhere else instead. There's an intensity of involvement and experience that is very filling and very fulfilling. And this is not a philosophical stance. This I'm talking here very very practically, very down to earth. But when we go through life and we're not really engaged in it, everything has a sense of unreality. It's like we feel like we're floating, we're adrift. It's like that's how I feel when I take a decongestants. It's just, I'm floating along. I can see that I'm here. I can't really tell where my feet are. Someone may talk to me on the phone. I may, you know, remember it or not remember it. It doesn't seem very real. And many times I know for myself, up until a certain point in my life, I had this feeling that I was waiting for my life to begin. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really articulate it that way, but it was that feeling of kind of holding back, of waiting for things to be a certain way, and then I'd do it. And I was fortunate enough to realize at a certain point that this is it. Mm-hmm. There is no point where you're then on stage and you'll let go and let yourself feel and interact and experience life fully. You either do it now, moment to moment, or you don't do it. And you don't get another chance. not at this particular, in this particular setting. You don't get another chance. Those experiences that came to you, the opportunities for growth and being helpful and so on, don't come again. There may be others, I don't know. I can't say that for sure. I don't know what happens when we're through here. Mm-hmm. But the ones that came to you in this life don't come again. And so I would say, yes, if you engage yourself fully with life, if you allow yourself to experience what comes to you in a deep way, that you would be more willing to go when the time came.
Mm-hmm. And that's the good, the bad, and the indifferent. I mean, we shouldn't say, oh, shouldn't. It's a funny word. I say shouldn't, and you say, well.
No.
Right? To analyze my language here, perhaps another show. We can't reject the bad because it comes to us in this life.
Oh, we want to. Yeah. Just to kick and scream and say, I don't want this. Why me? Well, why not you? Or why not me? Mm-hmm. What exempts any of us from whatever comes? I was sitting in the doctor's office several years ago in Fairbanks, and there was a young man sitting there with big casts on both his legs. And we started talking, and I said to him, well, what happened? And he said he'd been in a motorcycle accident, and then he told me he'd been in two or three other motorcycle accidents. And he looked at me, he said, God was trying to tell me something. And he said, this time I listened. You know, life gives us a lot of opportunities to wake up, to pay attention, to get it. And sometimes we're hard of hearing, you know. It's like we've got our earphones on, we're listening to other things. We don't get it. And some of those things are things that we prefer, things that we like. Some of them are things that aren't our favorite at all. Mm-hmm. And I don't know who's in charge of that.
Let's see if we can't, there may be some repetition here, and I think that's all right. But in talking about finding a way to live a balanced life, finding a way to heal ourselves of the imbalances within and to sustain that, maintain some sort of healing dance in our lives, talk to me about what we look for, what we hope to recognize, and what we hope to do towards that aim. Is that too vague, or can I ask you to do that?
Well, I think there will be some repetition. To me, balance has a great deal to do with dancing to the music that's playing. In other words, if I'm dancing the tango and a waltz is playing, I'm not very balanced, not very much in harmony. And so that requires listening. It requires attentiveness and then moving in harmony with whatever music's playing. And that means paying attention because the music's changing all the time.
I'm thinking as you're saying this, you're saying tango and waltz, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking my family's doing wonderfully and everything's fine and this is just the way I hope my family would be, and in the other room my son is suffering, whether over his algebra or his dearest girlfriend or his feeling that this family is no family to him. And so in some very serious ways, if I'm off doing the tango and my family is doing a waltz, I'm not only missing my family, but I'm also not in a position where I can reach to my family. Yes.
Right. It would be difficult to engage with them if your thoughts about what's going on are different than what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And how do we, with all our filters and with all our stuff, our thoughts about what's going on, for example, I'm again thinking about relationships, a son or a loved one of one sort or another. How do we begin to clear away so we can see whether the son, for example, is in a troubled state and how we can help and where we're useless to help?
Well, I guess I would say if I'm not noticing something, it may be that I'm not paying attention to what's going on. I'm instead having thoughts or impressions that are not clear. Mm-hmm. And that would tell me either that I am, it would tell me that I'm not paying attention in some way or another. If I were paying attention, there would be things that I could see, or if there were things that I could not see, there would be things that I could sense in some way or other.
And if we're mostly not sensing, this is what I'm asking, how do we do the grand task of sensing accurately what's going on with someone we care for?
I mean, if we're not sensing at all, if we're not...
If we're mostly cluttered with what we've been talking about for the last hour, our thoughts and our emotions and feelings about things.
Right. Then we don't really experience another person. I mean, I think we always experience other people in a distorted way to some degree or other, no matter how good our intentions are, no matter how much attention we're paying, simply because we are separate and we do have our own experiences and our own natures, which are not exactly the same. So I don't know that we ever truly experience another person exactly as we would all wish to be experienced by another person. And that is part of, I think, being a human being, is that that's painful. We all want to be seen completely as we are. We all want to be understood and known fully. And because we are human beings, we really can't be. Mm-hmm. Maybe sometimes in sudden flashes, we really get another person or another person really gets us. But you can't really get inside another person, and, you know, no matter how sensitive you are. I don't think we ever completely can experience without some of our own self getting in the way. After all, we are within this organism which has all its thoughts and experiences and characteristics, mm-hmm. and so on. But we can try.
And in some ways, do we need to be content in this life with not knowing, with imperfection?
As much as I hate to say it, yes. Of course. And I think all of that is open to interpretation. I mean, why couldn't you just say this is perfect, mm-hmm. for what it is? It is what is it? What it is, it's a perfect version of what it is. You know, we all strive toward being the best version of ourselves that we can be, which is not comparing ourselves to some ideal image, whether cultural or social or personal or gender-oriented or whatever, mm-hmm. but moving toward being the best self we can be, whatever that is.
And do you suppose it's acceptable, mm-hmm. to say, I am thus?
I am. Well, of course you are. What else could you say? It's obvious, isn't it?
Interesting discussion. I was just, mm-hmm. taking myself out of the present. Mm-hmm. My apologies.
Come back.
Well, no. I think I'm quite satisfied in terms of where we've walked in this hour. And you? I mean, we may as well check in with that, since our goal is to stay
very enjoyable
in the present. Mm-hmm. Good. And do you think we have said a number of the things we might say about healing and health and ways to approach them?
I think so.
Well, then I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
For an hour's discussion. I'm Susan McInnes. I've been with Sally Fenno for the last hour on Sunday at Noon. We've been talking about healing and health and living in the present. Thank you for being with us. Next week, I've invited novelist and nonfiction writer Richard Bass to join me. He has a great interest in engineering and oil. One of his books is called Oil Notes. It is a nonfiction work about the discovery and development of oil resources. His other book is a work of fiction. I will introduce both of them and him to you when we talk again on Sunday at Noon. Thanks for joining us.